because you're jumping back into the gap. I'll let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind BasketballImmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm here with Marwan El-Rakabawi. Marwan is a second-year assistant coach at Shriner University down in Texas. And most importantly to me, someone who's become a good friend and someone that we've connected with originally through social media, and then we had a chance to meet in person. And you made the trip to Milwaukee, and not many coaches making the trip from Texas to Milwaukee, but you made it to work basketball camp with me, a breakthrough basketball camp, and we had a great experience getting to know each other. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Coach. I really appreciate you having me on, and it was nice to get the application of BDT and some of the concepts that you talk about in person. So it was well worth the trip, and it sparked, you know, some of the conversations that led to this conversation. So I'm happy that we got a chance to do it.
Well, and we've talked about this to get together and kind of talk about the camp, and probably the original reason that you came to the camp was, even though you're a Basketball Immersion member, this gave you a chance to immerse in the concepts and see them through. Progression might be the wrong word, but a progressive nature in terms of building it for young campers, generally in the ages of 12 to 16, and you chance over 3 days to see that. All these concepts, how they layer and how they add to each other and hopefully how they purposefully develop skills and tactics. So can you talk a little bit more about why you came to camp?
Yeah, Coach. I mean, I think you laid it out there, but you know, what really sparked this was a conversation you had with Coach Jabo, I think early on in the podcast, might have been the second or third one you did. And you guys were talking about individual development and how you develop players. And that sparked a question in my mind. Did some of these BDT concepts and zero decision making, the things that we members of Basketball Immersion can see, and the videos that you post there are very, very helpful. But I really wanted to see it in a situation where you're trying to have players develop individually. And that's what's happening in a camp setting, right? These guys are not going to be playing together, right? These are kids taken from all over the place. So seeing, you know, some of those group concepts in person, but also being able to kind of zero in on the piece of it that's individual development, because you talked about with Mark, I think on that podcast, how important those hours are where the kid is by himself. So what tools can we give them? What kind of things do you teach in a camp setting that a boy or girl can then take on their own and work on their own? Because that's really the time, Coach, that they're going to get to where they want to be. It's not going to be when they're with a coach or in a team practice.
I couldn't agree more. I don't think there's a good player you or I have ever coached, or any coach has ever coached, that hasn't got better on their own to get to that level. And sometimes, despite the coaching, they've got better because they've just worked on their own. And what we're trying to do with the camp is really to teach them how to train on their own with the concepts that we have. And obviously, within the three-day camp setting, you have to mix in some other ideas and some other things like small side games, et cetera, that they can't do on own. But the whole focus is to get to be able to do some things on their own. We're going to get into a whole bunch of the camp stuff. But overall, then, after having seen it, what are your impressions of the camp overall?
Well, I took away some very specific things that I can do and apply. I get the opportunity at Shriner to coach our JV team. And so I have the opportunity to apply some of these concepts to team practice. But I guess if you talk about broad takeaways, Coach, the main thing is not being, and I think this is a theme that came up a lot, not being obsessed as a coach with perfect practice. And one of the phrases that you said over and over again at the camp that I've stolen and used quite a bit now is great job making a mistake, or great effort making a mistake, I think was the terminology. And so that was really a key takeaway for me, is that, and you talk about it a lot through various social media platforms, but this idea that, you know, basketball is messy, getting good at basketball is going to be messy. And we need to, as coaches, within skill development, within all the things that we do, whether that be just a team warm-up, embrace that messiness as part of the process of getting players and teams to where they want to be. So if I talk about an overarching takeaway, that would be it. And then what I've done is I've kind of broken down some different parts of ways that we could apply the things that you saw in camp to a team warm-up, team a middle of the year kind of practice, individual and player development. And I kind of wanted to talk through with you, you know, some of the motivations for some of these things and, you know, just get a little more color on some of the notes that I made. And so I think, you know, I'm not sure how, what you wanted to do, but I kind of think maybe at the beginning, go ahead, Coach.
Before you get there, let's just look, I appreciate that's a great takeaway, by the way. I mean, we're trying to communicate a safe environment. And I want to explain to coaches kind of how we do that, because what we do initially with all these players is, one, we try to explain to them that it's a judgment-free environment. Like, nobody's recruiting them. Nobody's comparing them. This is a development camp, that the process at this basketball camp, which is, you know, again, most camps now that kids go to, especially as they move up in ages, are recruiting camps. So they're playing games and they're getting evaluated. And the peer development camp that probably you or I grew up with doesn't necessarily exist. Now, there are some really good ones in the country, so I'm not saying that. But we're really, for 3 days, focusing on their skill development. So we talk to them about, the goal is not to be great. The goal is to get better. And then the other part that goes with that is that not just are mistakes necessary for learning, but they have to be able to feel comfortable making mistakes. And it's such a hard thing, because by and large, kids don't like making mistakes. And who's created that environment by and large is us as coaches. We've created this environment of, oh, you got to be perfect. So when they try to be perfect, they also are very safe. They do the things that they can do already. So there's no reaching beyond their current level, because they can already do something and they're comfortable just doing that and staying in that area. So that's such a challenging environment to get them out of. But that's why we focus on effort, not just in making mistakes, but overall effort in practicing. And that's all the fixed mindset stuff that Carol Dweck talks about, which is praising effort and making sure that we do those things.
And I think the Talent Code, which is a book I think we've discussed, you know, talks about that level where learning takes place is that level where you're making mistakes, a somewhat frequent.
Right. And we say it, fight for your learning. And it's all a struggle. Like, if you're not struggling a little bit, then you're not reaching and you're not learning. And all learning literature talks about that. And that's a part of this. And, you know, again, I say it frequently too, and somewhat it's sarcastic, but somewhat it's realistic too. It's like, I didn't come to Milwaukee to teach you things you know already. Right? Like, that's not the goal of a camp in my mind. It's not to come here and teach them all things they know already. Now, some players will be good at stuff faster, or they've already done some of the stuff. But by and large, it's my job as a coach to layer them, load them, whatever the term is, but to add challenge constantly so they have to fight for their learning within that struggle. And that's the overriding purpose of any of the basketball camps. And the other thing which you noticed a lot is that at these camps, like, these are youth basketball camps, like development camps for those ages, but they're also coaching clinics. Like, I really do love the coach education piece. So having people like you there, or any coach that comes out and helps at camp, is tremendously valuable to me. Because even, I just think about that Milwaukee camp, the questions that you ask me at that camp help me confirm or think differently about some of the things that I do. And again, that's part of this podcast, but I thought it was tremendous just having someone like you there to ask me those questions, to kind of, I don't want to say challenge me on ideas, but to make me think about why I actually do that, or what's my reasoning, or to come up with a different phrasing or whatever it may be.
Well, that's great, Coach. And it could be a whole other podcast, but just in terms of, so many coaches talk about the things that they learn, you know, from other coaches, but when you have players there too, and we're able to get that immediate feedback from what the players are doing and how they're responding, and then we can, and you do a phenomenal job of including the coaches in what you're doing in terms of explaining why you're doing it, where you're going with it. We had, you know, just great conversations at lunch. And yeah, if there's people out there that are nearby a camp that you're running, I'd highly recommend they go and help out, because I think it was basically a free coaches clinic.
Well, I appreciate that. And let's start with the first thing on your list, Coach, whatever it was in terms of those things that you sent me previously about a list.
Yeah, so, you know, Coach, I kind of broke this down into the, you know, the ways that you could apply, you know, things we saw at camp, and then talk about in the context of applying it then to a high school or college practice. So the first thing we did was, you know, in terms of some of the warm-up. And I don't know if it's useful to, you know, for those who aren't familiar, for you to, if you want to talk just briefly again about kind of what the idea behind basketball decision training in 0 seconds is, to kind of set the context for this. But we started with, a lot of folks start out with dynamic stretching or some kind of walk through, you know, layup, something like that. What we did instead at the in the camp setting was that became side dribbles. You work on different dribble moves, combos, and we're having guys challenge themselves. So they're getting, at least in my view, the same type of a dynamic warm-up, the movements that you would do there, but you're letting each player, each learner, go at their own pace, challenge themselves, and do some different things. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the philosophy behind, you know, why you start practice that way and what you do with your university team.
Well, so much of it is about maximizing time, as we've talked about. And I'm not anti, you know, dynamic warm-up. I'm fine. I value all that stuff. But I've just found that, look, I have a really small window to help people improve. And I want to maximize that time as much as I can. And without focusing on intensity, without focusing on competition, when we do different types of dribble moves, when we do different types of dribble moves in different directions, with different body movements, with different types of physical literacy involved, that we are essentially doing all that dynamic stuff while they have a ball. And I don't want coaches to think in terms of that's separated from the game. As we progress it, we do it all towards ending in a shot. And again, the intensity is what's modified. And that's where I deem it as a warm-up. And we're talking if it's 60, 70%, whatever it is, intensity, that they're still focusing on skill development. And again, slow learning is a part of the learning process. It doesn't have to be full speed initially. It's a representation of skill, but it's that skill happening right away within hopefully the context of how they're going to apply it. And basketball decision training for me, and I know we're going to get there within our season, that's warm up. Because again, our players are never stationary. They're moving, their hips are turning, their feet are moving, they're jump stopping, they're different directional movements. There's different passing movements where you're outside your body and you're getting this whole dynamic movement happening while you're working on skill development.
Yeah, I think that's great. And one thing you said there, I picked up on, and I heard something great from Nelson Taroba, who's the coach for the St. John Riptide up in Canada. He mentioned when he's talking to his players about doing things at 50% or 60% in terms of their physical movement, it's always 100% in terms of your technique and your focus. So when you do slow things down, it seems like that's a great opportunity to really redirect players' attention to their technique, to their focus, so that we're not just doing everything at 60%. So I think that's great, Coach.
That's a great connection too. That's the mental effort still is there. And that's the goal of anything that we do. And even at the end of practice, sometimes when we've had a hard practice, we'll go through, say, 4-on-4 offensive breakdown stuff, but we'll tell players, listen, it only needs to be 70% intensity, but defensive technique, defensive communication, defensive execution, as well as offensive execution are 100%. And that's exactly what you're saying. So that's a tremendous connection, Coach.
So I guess the next part was in terms of a practice, moving to some shooting, and a lot of folks like to start practice with some shooting. So the kind of block shooting that people familiar with your philosophy will know what that means in terms of just a spot where you're getting rebounds and getting repeated shots. In the camp setting, that became either a BDT cues where you're giving hand signals to the player in terms of whether he's going to have to make a shot or pass decision, or it was a 2-on-1 or 3-on-2 closeout situation where the ball is being delivered to a player on the perimeter, and then that player, based on the action of the closing out player, either makes a shot or pass decision. So again, maybe you could talk a little bit about how you use that and the philosophy behind it.
Well, again, I mean, shooting drills to me, I mean, there are some drills where we do, which are essentially on air. And BDT is essentially on air, right? Like, it's not a live defender. It's just a defender simulating what a defender would cue you with in terms of the decision. So for BDT, we consider that mind training. And for skills training, we consider that 0 seconds. And what BDT tries to do is it tries to bridge those things, two things together, so that we're still working on skills with the decision. And a lot of reasons for BDT, one is obviously we're increasing the enjoyment, hopefully, of the athlete training, but it's random and variable, as you alluded to, instead of blocked. But every decision that we do within BDT relates to the game, relates to a game decision. So if you have space, you shoot. If you don't have space, you drive it or you pass it. Like, just simplicity like that. And there's 4 decisions. We can go through those some other time, but that's basically it. So to connect BDT more closely to the game, we will mix in the two-on-one shooting or the three-on-two shooting, because that brings those things back to what we're actually trying to do, which is we're trying to execute those skills versus a live defender. And two-on-one shooting and three-on-two shooting still give the advantage to the offense, which gives comfort to the offense to focus on their skills while they still have the influence of at least one or two defenders. But they still, again, the offense should win. They have the advantage, and that's part of it. I mean, so much of offense is about mindset and confidence and, you know, building those skills that go with confidence, skill execution. So I think the two-on-one shooting and the three-on-two shooting help those things evolve a little bit for a player too. But we also use them to connect the idea for the learner to say, hey, listen, this is what you're working on in skills. Here's your application of those things. And you saw that we started camp with three-on-two shooting.
And that's right.
What a disaster that is, right? And it's at every camp. And so coaches know we use constraints, and the constraints are you shoot it or you pass it. There's no cutting. You know, there's no screening. There's no dribbling. And the two defenders need to play defense, which means don't let them score. And the offense is trying to score. And it's amazing. And I don't know if you remember, Coach, but what you see, what do the players do initially when we do that drill?
They hesitate and they don't know what to do. Can I shoot the ball? They're actually asking for permission to shoot the ball.
No, it's unbelievable. And they overpass it, and which connects back to an idea that we talk about too, which is these camps are selfish time. That I talk to players that, look, maybe you go back to your team and your coach designates you as a post, or your coach designates that, listen, what's best for our team is that we pass the ball 8 times before we shoot. That's great. I never argue against that. I'm never arguing, hey, saying their coach is wrong. What I'm saying is the focus of this camp is 100% selfish time, which is individual development. And that's completely different than maybe what your coach wants you to do within the team setting to help your team be successful. But what we're trying to do is to grow your skills and grow your confidence in your skills so that when you go back to your coach will give you more freedom. And that's ultimately it. So that's what we're trying to get to. But the initial part is that players, as you said, they overpass the ball because they've all been taught to pass, and a lot of them don't know when they should shoot.
And so piggybacking on what you said there in terms of competition, and, you know, the next thing that I recall was, you know, now you're doing 3-on-2 and now you let the guys play 1-on-1. I think that was the next, instead of layup lines, which might start a traditional high school or college practice, we're doing shoulder game, perceptual layups, and partner 1-on-1, which again, and I thought, well, what a great way to start practice in terms of building confidence, applying some of the skills that you're working on. Is that something, again, that with your university team, you guys are playing a lot of one-on-one, even at the very early stages of practice?
Coaches that have been to our gym know that I have limitations in terms of that. I would play one-on-one a ton more, but we literally have half a court for our practices with the volleyball team on the other side with a curtain dividing us, and we only get one full basket on each side, and the other basket's basically cut off. So I have some limitations in terms of playing a lot of one-on-one at the beginning of practice or at the end of practice, but I would if I could. But we do definitely value that. And if I was to develop young players, I think ultimately, I'm not saying I would skip so much of the fundamental development, but I would play an immense amount of one-on-one, different versions of one-on-one that are game-like. And I believe that players would self-discover and learn much better within that setting, because they have to figure it out. Like, and there's this whole mindset within one-on-one that I don't rely on anyone else, which I think is really positive for development, that I have to figure it out myself. Because the one advantage of basketball and disadvantage, greatest strength, greatest weakness, is that you always have teammates, right? So if you always have an excuse not to drive or not to shoot or not to play offense, the same on defense, you always have an excuse to get beat. Oh, I get beat. I have help. We're really good in help. Doesn't matter if I cover the ball, right? And this one-on-one mentality builds more of that mindset that's saying, hey, listen, I have individual responsibility on offense and defense that I'm going to be accountable for, and I'm going to take care of it. And that's what we hope to develop within one-on-one.
I thought it was great, and I thought it did just that. I mean, I think for players too, sometimes you need to have an understanding of where you're at, and there's nothing that exposes more of what you need to work on, whether it be your finishing moves, whether it be your ball handling, than just trying to score by the guy that's in front of you and not having, as you mentioned, that kind of support system around you in terms of teammates.
And you can add constraints to it. And we talked about that a little bit, but constraints, you know, would be, and we've talked about this at length. So hopefully coaches who have listened to me or been on Basketball Immersion know this, but you can't take two dribbles in a direction not towards the rim, right? It's not a dribble limit. It's a direction limit, so that you can't just go all right hand if you're right-handed around the defender. Like, you know, if the defender's angling you not towards the rim, then you have to work on a change. And then we also restrict them in the sense that no spin dribbles. Again, I don't want coaches to think I'm anti-spin, but I'm sort of anti-spin. But but it's literally a default for bad dribblers to spin. They're not attacking. They just turn their body and change. So
I want to push you a little bit on this, Coach. And this kind of brings me to a different point. So a lot of what I heard you talk about to those campers, and I thought it was great, and I think it gives them ownership, is about freedom. You know, we want you to have fun and have freedom to make mistakes and to do other things. So there were two rules that I recall from the camp. One was the spin dribble rule that you just talked about. Yep. And the other was when we were doing the perimeter 3-on-2 shooting, you were adamant that we weren't going to use bounce passes on the perimeter. I don't know if you recall that.
Yes.
So, you know, as I was reviewing and getting ready for this conversation, I thought, you know, there's some tension there between what Coach Oliver is saying in terms of that freedom. And the reason for the freedom is sometimes the fastest way to get something done is different in different scenarios. So I find some tension there with, for example, the no bounce pass on the perimeter, because that might be the fastest pass to get there if, for example, a defender's arm is in the line of a chest pass or an outside hand pass that you might throw. So maybe tell me why we're not having some tension here in terms of the freedom that you preach, and I think rightfully so, and some of these, I guess, you know, I don't call them pet peeves or just preferences in terms of execution.
Right. No, and that's a fair question. I mean, but it's also, for me, most of it has to do with these are things they do already. So I want the other skills to evolve. And sometimes to have other skills evolve, you have to create a constraint. And again, rule, constraint, you can use either word. I like constraint because it emphasizes more of a positive than a rule, which for kids often is a negative. But to have other skills evolve, you have to sometimes limit the things that they kind of by default do. And I think spin and bounce passes are by default sometimes things that kids do. And my anti-bounce passes, mainly that it slows the ball down. When the ball hits the ground, it slows it down. Now, again, if we were truly to play, say we play a small-sided game, we do some different things like that, then probably we wouldn't limit the bounce pass. But I've just noticed it through hundreds of camps that I've done, that if I don't restrict it, then kids by default bounce pass way too much. Because for whatever reason, they've been taught that the bounce pass is a really good pass. And I find, especially as you move up in levels, you see less and less bounce passes. You know, with the exception of, again, you get in the lane and you bounce pass to someone maybe, or on transition, there's a bounce pass. Maybe a post-entry, there's a bounce pass, obviously off ball screen. But those are very specific situations, but not as you're moving the ball freely around the perimeter, is there a bounce pass?
So that makes sense to me in terms of trying to develop other skills. And I think that leads really nicely to the next kind of portion of it. In terms of one of the key observations from the camp was the layering of skill. And I think you alluded to it in what you said earlier, and specifically in the context of finishing moves. So as we saw through the camp, we started with, I think it was a back pivot was kind of the first counter finishing move. And we really wanted to move away from one-handed layups, again, because as you just said, probably something that
one-foot layups.
I'm sorry. Probably because that's something that, you know, doesn't occur as much in a game, and that skill is probably there. So we went from back pivot layups, and then we went back pivot to a step through. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the thought behind that layering of kind of revealing different solutions to problems, as I think the way you termed it in the camp, throughout the 3 days that we were there.
Well, it's awesome that you noticed that terminology, because we use that all the time with our players when they get around the basket. And I'll ask them, was there a different solution? Or sometimes it's, you got to find a different solution, right? At the rim, sometimes you just got to find a different solution. We've got, for example, a really short player that when he jumps to shoot a layup within traffic, he's going to get blocked or it's going to get disrupted. And I tell him, actually, don't jump. You know, it's the old Steve Nash thing where you shoot it without leaving the ground, because it completely gets the ball up in the air faster. And that's just helping someone understand there's a different solution within the skills, same skill set that they have. So you've already hit on it. No 1 foot layups. One, because they don't happen as much as we coach them. Because against good defense, again, against bad defense, everything's irrelevant. But against good defense, there's usually help. So you don't get as many 1 foot layups, ball above your head, shooting the layup at the basket. It's usually some variation of a, if you're going off 1 foot, you're usually somewhat off balance or you're not in a direction 45 degrees to the basket. So that's one thing. The other thing is we want other skills to evolve. So we assume these are not like they've never played basketball before camps. These are, we assume they have some prior skill level. So we don't want to focus on a 1 foot layup. From there, I expose them to a back pivot, a push shot, which is a 2 foot stop around the charge circle. And then they're getting the ball up in the air. And then we get into air squares, which is different types of jump stops, but you're not facing the rim. You turn in the air and different things like that. But the progression is definitely to expose them to possibilities and then let them then decide what they're best at. And I've learned that in my coaching. I sometimes dictated to a player, hey, you need to have this finish. But what I learned is that finish didn't work the same for that 6'8 player that it did for, say, another 6'8 player. And that this player, hey, he's much better with the air square. And I was kind of forcing him to do a back pivot. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think we have to expose them and whatever your philosophy is to, say, 3 or 4 different finishing possibilities around the basket. And then from there, help them come up with their best solutions. Because our solution isn't always their best solution.
Yeah, I think that's great, Coach. There might be some coaches out there that aren't sure about that terminology, air square. Maybe you could tell them what you mean by that. I'd never heard that term, but it makes a lot of sense when I saw it.
Well, and I'm sure there's another term that coaches use, but it's just a situation, if you picture about, you get deep in the lane, you land with your shoulders to the rim off of 2 feet, and then you jump and you naturally fade a little bit as you focus on getting your shoulders around to the basket, but not your feet. Like, I think, again, another situation, we've talked about shoulder-to-chest advantage is offense and chest-to-chest is defensive advantage. Too often, I think we focus on being square at the basket, whereas if I watch most high-level players score around the basket, they're very rarely ever square. Now, their shoulders get square, but their feet rarely get square. Because if you get your whole body square, then you're square with the defender and the defender has the advantage. And I just find perceptual layups, which is honestly, again, at some point, maybe by the time this comes out, I'll have a blog out and I'll share this because I think it's such a cool idea that has evolved and I'll share where the original thought was. But it's just this concept of you never truly get a direct layup, right? You're always off balance or you're always some direction. So we talk about passing outside your body. We also talk about shooting and releasing layups outside your body. And that's really what this perceptual layup concept is all about. So,
no, that's great. And sure, you'll have a video up and explain that concept. I've thought it's been really great. And me and our assistant coach at Shriner, we work on those perceptual layups just between the two of us because they are, you see how your percentage of layups goes down a lot when you're shooting them in that kind of environment. And for coaches who aren't familiar with that concept, I'm sure you'd be able to direct them to it. But basically, it's the idea that you're going towards a basket with a defender who's going to take a step up and a step over in one direction. You don't know what direction that's going to be. And so being able to finish with that distracting information and keeping your eyes on the rim throughout the entire act of trying to finish the layup, I think is were the key teaching points that I saw in the camp related to that.
Great explanation. And the other part for coaches is that there's two perceptions, right? The first perception is the defender. The second perception is the rim. So you've got to make two decisions. And I think sometimes, again, we talk about layups. Well, if you shoot on-air layups, you're only talking about one perception, and that's the layup. But really, a layup is hard because of the decision before the layup, right? And that's what you're talking about there, is that first they have to make a decision about where the defender is, and second, they have to make a decision about actually the type of shot I'm going to shoot.
Yeah, that's great. I thought that was a great takeaway. So, Coach, you know, where I head next, you know, is kind of moving into more of a middle of the season practice. You know, again, if we're this whole conversation I've been trying to structure in terms of taking camp back to practice. And so I know you've talked a lot about new play installation, if we're talking about 5-on-0 versus 5-on-5 with cooperative defenders, or even 5-on-1 or 5-on-2 with scripted defenders. I don't know that I've heard you kind of talk a little bit more about exactly how that would work. If we're talking about scripted defenders, who would guard who? Is the defender always going to trigger a decision when we're talking about 5-on-1 or 5-on-2? So maybe that's something we can talk a little bit more about now. And it didn't really relate directly to the camp, but it was something that came out of it in terms of, again, applying the camp principles to what you might see in a high school or college practice.
Well, and again, this is the fascinating thing. And this is one of the things that I hope has spread the most about what I've shared is this concept of doing, first of all, teach a new play 5-on-5, not live 5-on-5, but 5-on-5. So the offense has, again, perception relative to where a defender would be, but also you're getting defensive reps. Every time we introduce a play, our defense, like I'll stop it for our defense if they're not in the proper position. For example, say we set a back screen. We'll talk about where the defender should be, our defender should be in defense in defending that back screen. And those are mental reps. So if we're doing it 5-on-0, I believe we're taking away an opportunity for our defense to get better too within that mental rep process. So that's a part of it. Now, the 5-on-2, 5-on-3, or 3-on-2, or whatever advantage, disadvantage you do. Yes, I believe if you're doing it from a guided perspective, you designate who the defender covers. And you designate who the defender covers, usually one of them at the point of the action that you want to emphasize, and the other one on the weak side. And they can cover anyone on the weak side usually, but they want to take away something on the weak side. So let's say it's a simple wing ball screen with three players on the weak side. So in that wing ball screen, we'll designate you cover the ball, and you can cover it however you want, or we can give them a constraint, say you can go over or under. And then from there, that weak side defender now decides, do they cover the roll, or do they stay to the weak side, or do they go 70-30, cover the roll for 30, and then recover the weak side for 70? That type of concept. So we're really trying to build a little bit of defensive decision-making too. And I think if you script and organize it too much for your defense, then they lose the ability to make decisions. And I will use these opportunities again to question the defense and say, hey, listen, what might have been a better decision there? How could you have busted up this play? You know, or how could you have disrupted it? Whatever that may be. So we try and, again, have different situations evolve for the offense based on how the defense plays it or how the defense covers it. And clearly in that example, that we could have a defender cover the ball and cover the screen. So there's complete disruption, and now the weak side has to get more involved in spacing relative to what the ball screen defense is. Or we could just have a player cover the screener. Or, again, we could have nobody cover the ball screen and just work on that jam and tag on the weak side, you know, depending on what you want. But so many possibilities. And honestly, again, this is why it's been so fun to share this concept with coaches. And I don't mean to, but when I shared some of these ideas with the Miami Heat, that was one of the fascinating discussions about some of the things that they brought out about it was, oh, we really do this on defense. So we would have this guy here working on this concept and this guy here doing this. And I was like, bam, they totally took it to what I hope would be another level because they're dealing with that level of player, but they tailored it specifically to what they would do. So it was an offensive and defensive drill for them.
Well, that's phenomenal. I think that's a really good explanation of kind of how you would use those scripted defenders. So that's really helpful. And it's brought me to some conversations, some interesting conversations I've had, because I've become very, interested in some of the stuff that you've taught through basketball immersion. And so, and I know you've said this, you know, you can make any drill better by just adding a defender. And I've had that conversation with coaches, and I guess it's brought some challenges back. And so I'd want to push those challenges to you, because there may be drills where what you're really asking the guys to do is to execute, and there's other distracting information. It may be a quick communication. It may be that they have to assign roles in terms of what parts of the floor they're going to run, or if it's a set on offense, what designated player they're going to be in that set. So could that be enough for some drills without adding any additional distracting information that would come with the defender? So I guess what I'm asking is, do you stand by that, coach? Is it really the case you think that every drill can be improved with a defender Or do you can see the point to some of the folks I've talked to that said, well, you know, some of these drills, there's enough distracting information in other ways, and we don't have room for another defender as well.
And that's all fair. And learning in and of itself is distracting enough, right? For a lot of the things that we teach, the complexity of some things that we teach, especially to new learners or to new learning situations, even if it's at a high level, that's a new skill or a new play, the initial part of learning is distracting enough. So I get that. But I would still argue the distracting information is not the information that happens in a game if there's not a defender there. Right? Because the defender ultimately is present in the game. There's nothing that you do in a game without a defender. So as quickly as possible, add the defender, would be my opinion. Like if you see them, like say, again, I don't know the example that you're talking about there, but you're using some drill, say 3-on-0, and there's some communications, or even there's some variability in saying, coach calls out a cue and they run an up screen. Coach calls out a cue and they run a ball screen. Like that's distracting information. They have to think, it's mixed. There's some contextual interference, which means there's some stuff messing around with your remembering what you're supposed to do. That's all good. But if they can do that the next practice, then it's time to add the defender, right? Like that's my progression in the learning process. If I'm going from on air to more game-like, if they can repeat the same drill the next practice, then I need to add the defender to make it more game-like. And I hope that makes sense. And I'm not, like, nobody's wrong, clearly. I mean, there's a lot of on-air teaching that leads to players improving or teams improving. But I'm just saying, from a playing experience, I believe we can increase the decision-making process by getting that defender there more realistically.
Well, I think that's great. And it's clear that you've got a unique and strong perspective on that. I think, as you've mentioned earlier, there are coaches that are being exposed to some of these ideas for the first time. And there's some, there's a way that things have been done. And so there may be some pushback, but I think that's a helpful way to frame it in terms of there may be some distracting information and you can do some things in that context the first time, but maybe if the next time at a defender, I think that's great, coach.
Well, and again, coach, everyone I share stuff with, especially like you just said, like, I don't want disciples. I want adopters. No, I want adapters. People who adapt the information, right? Because that's ultimately me giving it to you or me giving it to whoever it is. I mean, you're the one that thinks about it within the context of how you do things or what you believe in. And then you take it to another level or you take it to the level that works for you. And that's what's been amazing about this. And, you know, there haven't been probably enough coaches that have come back at me and said, that's a load of crap or that's ridiculous. But there's been a lot of them that come back and really kind of say, well, I'm not quite comfortable with that yet, but I kind of get it, but I got to play around with it before I use it. And that I love because I agree with that. I'm not saying, hey, listen, you should go to your next practice and do all this. No, I mean, that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about disruption. We're talking about this process of challenging and stimulating and you coming to your own conclusions.
So let's bring it back to that. I think this has been really helpful in terms of discussion of some of these concepts, but let's bring it back to, I think, what started this entire conversation in terms of individual player development and what you do in that camp setting, and then what you hope then those players can apply on their own, whether, you know, maybe they have a parent, maybe they have an older brother, but you know, it might be just be by themselves. What do you see as the key takeaways from, you know, camp where they're exposed to some of these basketball decision training concepts, 0 seconds training? What can they then do in those unseen hours to really help themselves improve?
Well, one is we talk about like individual player development becomes very intimidating to players. Like I think coaches and trainers and all of us frame it as really intimidating. And I try and encourage players to look at it and say 10 minutes. And we actually frame it, you only have to do 1 minute 10 times. And that's player development to start with. And maybe you have a passion for it and you go 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it is. But to get purposeful practice done, like I'm like, let's just start with 10 minutes. Go out on your own 10 minutes and get better. And if we can get players to do that, they will improve. Because most of what players do, as you know, is coach-led or trainer-led. And again, I just don't think you can ever reach your best level if it's only coach-led or player-led. So we really try and encourage that. So how do we get them to do that? Well, the number one thing is they always have a ball in their hand. As much as possible at our camps, and you saw it, as much as possible a player has a ball in their hand. Would you give a percentage to that at camp? Is it 70% of the time they have a ball?
I might say it was either even closer to 80. I mean, yeah, they always have a ball in their hand. I mean, the only time they don't is probably when we're doing small-sided games where they're just on the floor playing but don't have the ball in their hand.
Right. So that's number one, is teaching them what to do when they have a ball in their hands. Because, again, so much of what they're exposed to sometimes is just the drill that involves other players. So I think a great mindset is to be able to teach them how to train on their own with the ball. So we do what's called mixed drills, and that's really the focus. And the whole basically last 2 hours of camp, but the last one of those hours in particular, is focused on, I think at this point I have over 200 different mixed drills where they have a ball in their hands and they're mixing some variation of footwork, fight for your feet, which is the ability to get your feet to the ground prior to a shot or some type of finishing move, and then some type of ball handling, some type of ball pickup, and then again, some type of scoring, shooting. Everything that we do in an individual workout, a player gets to shoot. And that's the first thing, is that with these mixed drills, look, we could train ball handling in isolation, meaning, and we do that a little bit with kill the grass and different things like that, but by and large, that's just to introduce a concept, but we want them to say a mixed drill example, three times between your legs, fight for your feet, pop the ball means ball pickup, shoot the ball. So you're going to do that within 1 minute of your 10 minutes. That's 1 minute. Now, the layers of it, which I think is ultimately the beauty of what I've learned from so many others, is how to add challenge or layers to it is, well, where can we add challenge? That example. Well, one, don't face the rim. Two, force them to do something where there's a different type of combo. So you change direction, you change the dribble, you change the rhythm of the dribble. Three is obviously that next level, which is somehow that we add some type of decision, which is BDT, etc., which again, on their own, they can't do as much. But that's the progression that we get to. So we get players to do a whole bunch of these mixed drills. It could be with a dribble, it could be without a dribble, you know, but that's by and large what we want them to work on their own and spend an immense amount of time with the basketball in their hands to get comfortable with the ball.
I think that's so important what you just said, Coach, in terms of, you know, I have players all the time ask me, you know, what can I do? What can I do to get better? And there's lots of resources out there. There's obviously tons of videos and different things. But I think what it comes down to and what you just articulated is you've got to be somewhat creative with the skills that you're working on and that you're building up to. So whether that's different combinations, and we saw it in the camp, you expose them to some of those combinations. But ultimately what kids do is figure it out, right? They got to figure out what combos they can do. They got to figure out how to do them more quickly. They got to figure out different ways to finish around the rim. I believe that a conversation you had earlier, you know, talking about Kyrie Irving and how did he get so good at finishing around the rim? It wasn't because a coach told him a specific way to do it. That kid just spent a lot of time with a basketball finishing in different ways around the rim. So, you know, I think there's a huge desire for there to be this elixir, you know, just drink this, just do this, and you'll be better. But a lot of it is you got to go out there and do it, and you got to challenge yourself and see what you can accomplish and what you can put together, because every player's game is going to be unique. And that's what really ultimately makes them special, is when they figure out what it is about their game that they can do better than the next guy.
Can you imagine if there was that coach that taught Kyrie how to finish like that? Hey, Kyrie, like, turn your finger like this, hit the backboard exactly in this spot with this exact amount of spin. Like, that would be incredible. Like, and again, I'm sure there's some biomechanics professor somewhere that could completely break down the whole aspect of him finishing. But think about the variations of that skill. Like, again, like the complexity of that is just mind-boggling. And there's no coach that can coach that. We can give them ideas and we can give them direction. But ultimately, as you said so well, there's got to be self-discovery. For a player's skill to evolve, there has to be a tremendous amount of self-discovery. And I'd say there's two things. One is players that are in the gym on their own, purposely practicing. As I said, in our version of it, it's mixed drills, but it could be shooting, it could be doing different things, just spending time with the ball, getting comfortable with the ball. And the second thing is players' self-direction in playing and organizing one-on-one. My freshmen yesterday after practice on their own, not coach led, organized some one-on-one. Now they were different one-on-one versions that we played, but I walked out of that gym feeling like, okay, they value their development. They value their possibilities. And this was the same group of players, so coaches know, that I had to have a conversation with, because our freshmen are, I believe, really talented, and in some cases will be better than some of our veterans as the season progresses. And I had to explain to them that they're not just going to work out for their own benefit. They also have to show the rest of the team that they value their development, because when they pass some of those veterans, they've got to earn it. It can't be just me giving it to them because they're more talented. There has to be that perception from everyone that, wow, these guys really do get better. They really got better because they worked. And them doing that added credibility to that whole conversation.
That it brings up a point we haven't discussed. I want to make sure we mention to the coaches, but one of the benefits of doing, you know, some of these things, you know, in terms of incorporating in your warm-up one-on-one or different things where players are interacting with each other, and you've said it in the past, you know, you make that defender or that other player an active participant in the learning of the player with the ball. And I just think, in terms of a culture, what better is it than that partner having to care about his teammate getting better? Because really, none of this stuff works unless the players are willing to give effort on both sides of the ball. And so I think you've got to challenge yourself as a player. You've got to challenge your teammate as a teammate. And so just setting that kind of direction and culture at the beginning of practice, I thought was a very valuable takeaway from applying some of these camp concepts to, you know, your high school or college team.
Well, and we all say it, right? Like, oh, you know, I can't believe, there's almost every camp or every situation I go to at some point, coach mentions, oh, look at them. They're just firing 3-point shots. I'm like, okay, well then let's give them other possibilities. Like, they don't want to come in the gym when they first get there and work on pivoting. Like, I'm sorry, that's not fun for kids. They don't want to self-organize and work on pivoting. They love to self-organize and shoot the ball and see how far they can shoot the ball from. So let's give them something else to self-organize with and say, hey, like, because they want to be social. And that's the other thing that I found. When players walk in the gym, guys or girls, they want to be social. They want to interact with their teammates. They want to have fun with their teammates. So it's like, can we get them into this self-discovery of saying, let's self-organize one-on-one. Hey, guys, I don't care. When you get in the gym, find some teammates. Find a group of three. I think three is better than two, because then there's some interaction in different ways, and just, hey, play some one-on-one in the post. Maybe you don't play one-on-one in the post. Well, play one-on-one in the perimeter. Just do some stuff like that. And then maybe we wouldn't be having that conversation all the time about them shooting so many threes at the beginning of practice or half court shots, right? Give them other possibilities.
Well, and that goes to, you know, probably the last thing is just in terms of the motivation, right? I think one of the concepts I took away was really trying to create intrinsic motivation. One of the things I wrote down that you said, you know, my job isn't to motivate you, but to create the conditions in which you can be motivated. And I thought that was great. I mean, your conversation recently with Phil Beckner about giving kids something that's fun in the context of a workout, I think that was individual development. But I think it ties into exactly what you're saying. You give players the tools and then they can self-organize, be motivated, recognize there's ways for them to improve. I thought that was great. I thought that was good stuff.
Well, thank you. And again, the whole point is teachers, parents, coaches, there's other professions, but we're just sometimes, well, I don't think sometimes, we're mostly mislabeled as motivators. And I don't think there's a speech, and I don't think there's any type of gimmick I've ever done that's motivated a player. Like, what motivates a player is create a condition for them to get better. And real motivation for a player is seeing themselves improve. So superseding anything that you do, you have to notice their progress and you have to point out their progress and say, okay, you couldn't do that, or you used to really suck at that and now you're not that bad. Okay, now you used to be not that bad and now you're good. Oh, you used to be good and now you're better than good. You know, whatever the phrasing is, but it's not this progression of saying, oh, you suck and now you're great, right? That's not noticing progress. Noticing progress is those small steps along the way. And that, I believe, is what motivation is. And that's also what I believe is building self-esteem. Like, nothing builds self-esteem more than a player feeling like they're getting better and they have an ability to contribute more. And more kids would be retained in any sport if they felt themselves getting better, right? Even if you're not the star, you're feeling yourself getting better. You see yourself improving. You see yourself being valued. And in basketball, I don't care what it is, value is scoring. Like feeling that you have the ability to score is the most value you could ever contribute to yourself and to the team, probably. You know, again, it's great to be a great defender, so I'm not saying don't do that. But like, let's be honest. Did you grow up dreaming about being a great defender? Like you grew up dreaming about making the big shot, right? So, we got to help offensive skills evolve so that we help kids enjoy the game more.
Couldn't agree more, Coach. Couldn't agree more.
Well, Coach, this has been amazing, and we're going to do this again because I think it's a wonderful conversation, and I love your thought process, and I love the stimulating questions, and hopefully this was beneficial to coaches. But tell them quickly, where can we follow you on social media? And you'll be contributing some things as we move forward too, I know, to Basketball Immersion. So thank you for that.
Yeah, Coach, I really appreciate the conversation and what you've done to stimulate my coaching. I'm on Twitter and Instagram. Twitter is M. L. Rockabowie. You can figure out how to spell that. Find me on the Shriner website or at Instagram. It's Coach Rock'em Baby, just how it's spelled. So just to make it a little easier. So I love to have conversations with coaches similar to these. I just find them so illuminating. So feel free to reach out to me if you want to have that conversation.
Perfect. I'll include that in the show notes as well. Thanks, Coach.
Thanks, Coach.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.